Hello, everyone. My name is Gabriel Barry, and I am the director of Cyrano de Bergerac, one of the new productions by Resonance Ensemble playing at St. Clement's Theatre on West 46th Street through the month of February. I'm very excited to be working on this production, as I'm not only directing the production, but also playing the role of Cyrano in the show. Most recently on Broadway, I have directed the production of Amazing Grace. I also directed the off-Broadway production of Wild Party, and many, many other off-Broadway shows and national tours. And I also work in the Czech Republic and Asia. Very, very excited to be based here in New York and finally working here in New York again. As an actor, I appeared on Broadway a number of times and was nominated for a Tony Award for my performance in Starmites. And so I'm very glad to be treading the boards again as an actor as well. Particularly excited to have surrounded myself not only with a fantastic design team, but a fantastic, talented group of seven other actors interpreting this piece with me. Together with Rick Sordelet and Alex Savronsky, I have adapted the play for eight actors total. So it's a really exciting romp through the piece that adds a tremendous emotional weight to it, as well as adds greatly to the humor, and with musical score that underscores much of the play, as well as adds a few songs here and there. I think the piece is very lively and enlightening and a lot of fun. So we hope you can all come down and see it. I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, my friends, my theater-loving friends. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am thrilled and delighted to be talking with a new friend of the neighborhood. His name is Gabriel Barry. He has a long, long resume, both as an actor and director on and off Broadway. Among his credits are a Tony nomination for the musical Starmites. He also directed that really terrific musical Wild Party off Broadway at Manhattan Theater Club, which was so much better than the Broadway one. And then he also most recently directed Amazing Grace on Broadway, about that Goyesha song. And right now you can go see him off Broadway acting and directing in the classic play Cyrano de Bergerac. We have him here right on the nose, ladies and gentlemen, Gabriel Barry. Welcome and shalom.
Shalom to you, Rabbi Saul, and thank you for being here. And I love the nose pun. Well done, well done.
Well, I do tell all those nose puns in Cyrano. It's the most famous scene where you get to make all those jokes. You're basically fending off the jokes by telling your own.
Exactly. Good technique I think more politicians should use.
Let me ask you, though. You're doing an adaptation of Anthony Burgess's version of, or translation of, the Edmond Rostand original. Why did you feel the need to, quote-unquote, adapt it? Or how much adapting did you do?
Sure, thank you. And this came about for a couple of reasons. I had a long love affair with the play itself. I just love the play. I think it's an almost foolproof play with a fantastic story. I think borne out by the fact that it's been used in so many, many films and offshoots through the now 100-some-odd years that the play has been in existence. So I love the play. But what I found, having done a couple of productions of it in the past, in some cases distant past, is that a lot of theaters that would normally consider the play, because they love the story so much, actually rule it out because they consider it unproducible. It's very difficult period to costume. It usually requires a large cast. If people think of it as a grand, elegant, lavish type show and production. The collaborators and I, Rick Sordelet, who's a well-known fight director on Broadway, he's done many, many Broadway shows and movies, and Alex Savronsky, who's a very talented actor and composer, the three of us got together and we said, wouldn't it be great to create a Cyrano that anyone could produce and figure out a way to tell the story with a minimum number of actors without shortchanging the audience on the meat of the show and the dialogue and the great relationships between Christian and Roxanne and Cyrano and, of course, De Guiche as well. So that was our goal, and we also felt the piece. I've read many, many musical adaptations of Cyrano. None of them, in my mind, have been successful, with one rare exception. Frank Wildhorn has one that I'm actually trying to direct as well somewhere in this country. It's already played in Japan and a few other countries quite successfully. He wrote it with Leslie Brickus, who he wrote Jekyll and Hyde with. And they've done a very smart thing with that musical version of Cyrano. But apart from that, I've never seen a musical of this production work well.
Did you see the on Broadway a few years, seasons back?
Yeah.
They had that one from, I think, Holland, which came in. That was all right. Do you remember the song, Sarah No, it's lots of fun, he's lots of fun for every nun, because there were all these nuns singing this. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do now. And I look, they had some great stuff in it, but ultimately for me, and then maybe I'm prejudiced, if you will, towards the material, but it's very hard to musicalize some of those beautiful speeches of Ross Stans without dumbing them down to make a lyric. Many times the songs become less intellectually provocative and less razor sharp in terms of the wit in some of the adaptations I've heard. So my point is that the language itself is musical in this piece. However, because of its romantic nature and the atmosphere that the piece generates, and because of the humor that's threaded throughout, I've always heard music with the piece. And so Alex and Rick and I set out to create an original score that could be a part of the telling of this story without imposing itself by way of converting major speeches into songs. So what we've come up with, I think, is a wonderful blend, balance, if you will, of text and music, where we've got some underscoring for certain text. We have songs in some of the transitions that do tell the story as well as change the locale. And we've come up with a really fun, simple way of producing the show that makes it extremely producible, fun to watch. The actors are out there all the time changing costumes. We have every actor except for Cyrano plays other parts as well as their principal role. So it's fun for the audience. And what's amazing is even the few rehearsals we've had so far with people, the audience goes with it right away and they really enjoy that aspect of the show. So that was one of the main reasons we wanted to create a version of this play that's highly producible, that accentuates the fun and humor in the piece and also brings a musical element to it. It's an ongoing developmental process, of course, but we're very proud of where we've gotten with it, and so far audiences are really enjoying it too. Hello everyone, my name is Gabriel Barry and I am the director of Cyrano de Bergerac, one of the new productions by Resonance Ensemble. I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By.
Here is kind of the touchiest question perhaps that I will be asking you in this interview here. You're a good-looking guy, you've been an actor, a lead actor, etc. You do physically, facially have a prominent nose. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Was it weird to think about doing Cyrano? But would it affect you in a certain way? Does the material speak to you in a certain way because you have a prominent proboscis?
Actually, it does, yes. I mean, I, without begging for any sympathy whatsoever, I certainly was teased about my nose growing up. And so when I actually thought about becoming an actor professionally, and I was in high school, I had to come down to New York from Vermont, where I grew up, and audition for an acting school here. And, of course, my acting teacher, who I'm still in touch with, my English teacher, actually, who was the drama teacher at high school, he suggested I look at Cyrano de Bergerac. And so I read the play when I was a teenager, whatever, 15 or 16, and immediately saw myself in the role of this character, partly because of that, I think. Yes, people had made fun of my nose growing up, and it was a source of humiliation, and it, in part, made me who I am, of course, which I'm grateful for. I'm glad to be who I am.
Well, did you become an actor to be like, I'll show them?
Light? I wouldn't say it motivated my wanting to become an actor, per se, but it certainly motivated my fascination with and interest in and love for this character. And so when I auditioned to become an actor in an acting school program, I used a speech from Cyrano. And so my relationship to the material goes that far back, and that was a while ago. I since had a chance to play the role under the direction of David Feldschuh, Tova Feldschuh's brother. And we collaborated on the translation for that and did it up at Cornell University, which I did as a guest artist. And then I played the role in 1998 at the Drew University campus through the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey. And that was under the direction of Bonnie Monti, the beautiful woman who played Roxanne in that production, named Tricia Palluccio, a wonderful actress, a year later became my wife.
I was going to say, be careful, your wife just walked in, and you're talking about this beautiful actress woman, but you marry her, mazel.
Yes, and so we fell in love doing the play and married a year later, and now have two beautiful children as well, and I mainly been directing for the last 15 years, but a couple years ago had a chance to try out some of the ideas we're now doing in the production off-Broadway at Rutgers University as a guest director slash actor with a much bigger cast. We tried some of the design ideas and some of the concepts to this production, such as live sound effects. There's no pre-recorded sound at all. All of the sound effects are done live, either using instruments or using blurred Foley-type sound effects. So it's another fun aspect of the production in 2013. And that sort of led to this production here in New York under the auspices of the Residence Ensemble Theater, which is a wonderful theater company dedicated to doing one classical piece a year and then a play in rep with it that is loosely based on or directly based on that classical piece. So this month, the month of February, they're running Cyrano opposite a new play called Burning, which is a really wonderful, moving tale.
Sounds like it's about my prostate. What is it?
It's actually an Iraq war a military play setting, and so I understand it's quite wonderful. It's starring Kathy Curtin, who just won a SAG Award as an ensemble member of Orange is the New Black, that she's been on for a while. So there's two great shows playing right now, but of course I'm here to talk about Cyrano, and most excited about folks coming to see that show and seeing what we've done with the play, and seeing again the fellow cast of remarkable actor musicians.
We are here to talk a bit about Cyrano, but we also want to talk about your life as a performer, Gabriel Barry.
Sure.
And you are married with two little Barryettes, or if they're male, Barryums. So the question is, you're directing, which means you have to go all over the place. As you said, you're in Rutgers, you're here, you're there in Czechoslovakia, you said in your intro. How do you balance being a dad and a husband with having to go away for a month or two or three at a time to do your work?
Well, it's a really great question, and the best answer, and probably the only answer, is that I have a wonderfully not only understanding wife, but a gifted wife who has a full career as an actress herself, but also, when I'm not here, takes charge of everything. So I'm very, very grateful for that, obviously. Couldn't do it without her, and I try to look at the bright side. When I am here, I do my best to pull my share of the work, and it also affords us to take the kids to places like Prague. I mean, I didn't go on an airplane till I was 21 or 22 years old, and yet Tristan, my oldest, who's 8 now, has been to Prague 4 times, sometimes for a summer at a time. So, they're just getting a chance to explore the world and see parts of the world that I never did at their age, and I think it's really exciting for them, too. So there's some benefits, and I try to look at those, and I hope my wife does, too.
Now, speaking of things that go all over the place, you were the director, or perhaps are the director, of the national tour of the Broadway show Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella. Now, Mark Rokaw directed that on Broadway. So what are your duties, I said duties, when taking a show that was directed by somebody else, but reproducing it around the country? Do you put your own stamp on it? Do you have to carbon copy his stamp? What do you do?
Well, actually, I should clarify.
Oh.
The tour of Cinderella that I directed happened in 2000, 2001, 2003, and predated the production. So
sorry.
It was a production all unto its own. In fact, that production that I directed and conceived is available by license. I think they call it the Enchanted production, and it really was enchanting. We reconceived the show. We added puppetry, which, of course, they did for the Brokaw production as well. But our script was sort of handed to us, and we weren't allowed to adjust it much, and the script we used was basically the script from the, I believe it was 1997, Disney TV movie, which Rob Marshall choreographed. So it was that production that we sort of took on the road in those years, starring Eartha Kitt and Jamie Lynn Sigler and Debbie Gibson, and at different points through the 3 years, it starred different people. It was a highly successful production that played here in New York, actually, at Madison Square Garden a couple of times, garnered a wonderful review from the Variety, which encouraged R&H to consider a Broadway production for the show, as one had never been done. The show, as you may know, was written in 1957 for television.
Right.
And was done as a live broadcast, one of the first few live broadcasts that happened in that decade, as is kind of well known for that. So the tour I directed was not an offshoot of anyone else's production. It was my own, and I maintained it myself for those 3 or 4 years it was out. It also played at many other regional theaters, subsequently, many of which I also directed.
But here's the reverse question then. You kind of nurtured that enchanted version along. Was there a day that you then opened? I mean, as an actor and a director, people go through rejection and disappointment all the time. Did you open up Variety one day and say, oh, God damn it, they got Mark Brokaw to do this? I did it. What the hell?
Well, yeah, to some degree, of course that happens, and I would be lying if I said I wasn't affected at all by the fact that the Cinderella made it to Broadway and it wasn't my production. However, I do recognize what they tried to do for Broadway was completely different from what I did. They rewrote the book entirely. They cut many characters. Now, could they have asked me to do that? Sure. But they may have felt they wanted to just do a clean slate. They got a writer and a director who I think knew each other well and worked with each other well, so I'm sure that was a factor. Even though Mark had done tons of musicals, I think he was great at working with this writer, and what they came up with was very interesting. They had a great design team, and I think it looked great. It certainly was successful for the time it played on Broadway. There are obviously different perspectives on the piece, but I think they achieved what they wanted to with it, and I think I did too.
It's almost the same question. You directed the very first version of Memphis, the musical that went on to, again, come to Broadway and even won the Tony for Best Musical that year. Again, did you feel left out of the process, or you were there for that first one, and whatever happened, happened?
Yeah, no, that was a little tougher because in this case, they continued to do rewrites on the show, but they didn't overhaul the concept of the show. And so I have to say that was a bit of a tougher one, especially because I'd become friends with Joe and David and still consider myself one. And I had contributed a lot of ideas and work on that piece as well. But listen, these things happen, and it happens all the time. That happens for various different reasons. I don't know the reason in that case, but oftentimes I'll tell you, Amazing Grace was technically my first Broadway credit as a director, and a lot of times when producers are faced with raising money for a show, they can't go to their investors with somebody who's never directed on Broadway before. They're often told by people or just feel on their own that they need somebody with a track record, and so that's not an unusual refrain to hear as an actor or a director or, frankly, any other position. Any designer has gone through that as well. Choreographers go through it. Very common to have that kind of catch-22 of Broadway. It still has that allure of like, well, if you've done Broadway, you're a professional, or not just a professional, but if you've done Broadway, you're capable of doing Broadway. But until you do Broadway, you're not, or you're just riskier, let's put it that way, in terms of raising money. And so it may have been that. I have to, at a certain point, let it go, of course, and depersonalize it, because otherwise you'll just eat yourself up. So I try to move on. It's not always easy to do it instantly, but I think, like you said, I think in any business now, people face rejection. The economy going up and down the way it has over the last few years and so on, I think it's something many people have to get used to. But certainly in the arts and certainly in show business, it comes with the territory, and you have to just be ready to get back up and try again and try to learn from it and grow as an artist, as a person, deepen as an artist and a person, figure out a better way as a person and an artist. So that's how I've gotten through this, is try to grow through it. And I continue to make a living in the theater and contribute to raising my family here in New York in Midtown Manhattan where we live. And I consider myself very, very lucky and blessed to be able to do that. And that's what I cling to. I have a happy life, and I'm thrilled and extremely lucky.
Tui, tui.
A living.
Spit through the fingers, knock wood, you know, halibi.
Yeah, doing something that I love to do and to make a living at it. That's all a person can ask. And that's, of course, what we try to teach our kids to build talent where talent exists, of course, but you got to be able to make a living at it too.
Can I ask you about current Broadway? I mean, yes, there are still hits and smashes and blockbusters, but it's very, very tough for a new serious musical. A revival, a lot easier, but a new musical. You directed Amazing Grace, then you had Allegiance, another serious musical this year.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way that these things can be hits? It almost seemed like before they even opened, there was a sense that they might be okay, they'll get okay reviews, but they're just not going to pay off.
I acknowledge that, and I do think it's an uphill struggle for shows like that. And the fact that either one of those shows made it to Broadway, and let alone in the same season, I think is a minor miracle in and of itself. I think the producers of both those shows are to be highly commended for the courage and tenacity to push those pieces through. weren't easy to do, and they weren't vanity productions, and they weren't handed to people. So just to see something like that through is great, and I think the more producers that are encouraged to do it and somehow find the courage to do it, the better, because that will pave way, theoretically, for other shows. Obviously, if you can have a smash success doing that, that's better. And, you know, certainly in the past, shows like Les Mis have proven that you can have a serious or in that case, literary piece that can do extremely well. So I don't think it's limited necessarily to the tone of the piece only, but it is an uphill battle. However, I am proud to say that Amazing Grace will have a very full and active life. We are now currently booking a tour that will go out in 2017. We have a cast album that's coming out in a matter of weeks, which is highly anticipated by anyone who saw the show and by many, many others. And I think we'll help promote the tour as well.
So can I ask you, now the Broadway show is closed, but how do you participate? You keep saying we. Do you get... are you involved with the tour? Do you get residuals? Do you get...
Yes, I'll certainly direct the tour, and I'm obviously intimately involved with the cast recording, and we've just still been continuing the final mixes on that, and but as I said, that should be out soon, so I was involved in the process of that. And I think the life that Amazing Grace will have will be in part due to its life on Broadway, however longer it might have been. The fact that we landed there and stayed for 4 or 5 months, I think, was certainly did what we hoped it would do, which is create a brand for the show and open up the door for future possibilities for it. We're pursuing productions overseas as well, including in Korea and other markets there. So I do think the show will have a life, and in part that life will be due to the fact that it had a Broadway stay. Yes, of course, I'd love the climate to be different so that a show like that could thrive for years, as many others do. But it is tougher. It's tougher to do that with serious material, I guess you want to call it that. It's always been tougher. The trick is that it still costs the same. So, you know, it's too bad that the serious shows can't be cheaper somehow to put together.
Well, Fung Home is pretty, you know, it's a room, it's a small family. Yeah. They manage that, so...
That's a great example. So I refuse to be discouraged about shows that can be, quote-unquote, serious or have a serious subject matter making it on Broadway. And Fung Home's a great example of one that did just that, and it certainly is not that as costly to run. It's a smaller cast, and obviously they're running at Circle, where they've had to keep their budget proportional to that venue, and they've done so very, very well, and that's going to have a tremendous long life. And, you know, even a show like Hamilton, which is the biggest mega hit you could ever hope for, if you described it on paper, you wouldn't think it had much of a chance either. So I think it's pretty exciting, and it's always you know, a huge mystery, of course, as to what succeeds and what doesn't on Broadway, and I think that's what keeps people creating things and keep producers producing them, and some of that I hope never goes away. I hope it never becomes predictable, because a lot of otherwise worthy work might get pushed aside or never get created. It's too hard and too long a process to not at least have hope for shows like Amazing Grace.
Now, speaking of being hopeful and things going forward, I do... well, by the way, we're talking with actor-director Gabriel Barry, who really came to most people's attention all the way back in 1989 when you were Tony-nominated for a musical called Star Mites. Now, I did not see it, but Dave, who is the producer of this radio program, even though it was a very enjoyable, fun show, it was not the golden years of Broadway back then, but it was a nice show. People see it as kind of a goof, but your Tony nomination, did that make a huge difference in your career?
I wouldn't say as an actor it made a huge difference as a career. I didn't notice. I mean, I constantly worked as an actor. I was lucky to pretty much stay employed as an actor doing off-Broadway, Broadway, or regional theater, and I continued to do that after that. I wouldn't say I was had huge new opportunities that I didn't before, but it certainly doesn't hurt. in theater, and anybody in this business knows that it's not a ladder. You don't just go up a rung at a time. You basically just keep working and hopefully growing, as I said earlier, as a person and an artist. And I was able to do that. And if you're not enjoying the process and the being in the now, then it's not the right business for you. But it certainly helped in terms of reputation, in terms of credits and so on down the line.
Do you have any fun anecdotes about Star Mites? Anything funny happened backstage? Any cool audience?
Oh, yeah. Well,
ooh, tell me.
One of the things was we opened a theater with that show. It was it's no longer there. It's where Roundabout was for a few years as well. It was called the Criterion Center.
Oh, yes.
And it was right in the thick of Times Square, and it was a smallish theater, like 600-800 seats, I think, and then they had a smaller cabaret space where Roundabout was at this space for a long time, and there was a few shows there, but we were the first show in there, and we had some really interesting things. We had what our director brought in a shaman to bless the space, did an Indian ritual, and the next night one of our actors fell off the stage or something and hurt themselves. And we had a fire curtain go off prematurely and douse a bunch of instruments and warp our stage floor. And then we had, in the middle of a performance at one point, we had a fire alarm go off, and the whole audience and the cast had to go out into the middle of Times Square. And I played a sort of half-human, half-reptile, if you can believe it.
Yes, I saw it, yes.
So I'm standing in Times Square in the middle of with a giant lizard tail and makeup that took an hour and a half to put on. Of course, today it wouldn't stand out at all, but back then it was a little bit odd but fun at the same time, because we couldn't really help it.
Well, if you saw the movie Birdman, it's kind of the scene.
It's very much a Birdman sort of feeling. Very much a Birdman sort of feeling. Yeah. So I played a lot of animals when I was more active as an actor, and I often say that as a director now, I'm working my way down the food chain.
Well, yeah. By the way, if you want to see the acting and directing of Gabriel Barry, our guest in the neighborhood, you do need to see Cyrano de Bergerac. He also helped adapt it into a play with music, I guess you would call it. And where can people see it again?
We're going to be at St. Clement's Theater on West 46th Street through the month of February. And you can go to the Resonance Ensemble Theater website and check out the playing schedule. And we alternate with another play called Burning, which is loosely based on Cyrano. So it would be great if you could see both, because I think you'd really enjoy the comparison. You might want to see Cyrano first if you're not familiar with the play, and that way you could really appreciate what the playwright of Burning put together as well. But we play there in rep through the month of February.
Through February, Resonance Ensemble. Now, a couple more questions, because I love to ask actors and directors about the people that they've worked with. Funny stories, good stories, or even not so good stories if the people are dead that they dealt with. So, do you have any great memories working with Eartha Kitt? Because you mentioned she was in that tour of Cinderella that you did. Any Kirk Eartha stories?
One of my favorite ones is Eartha. You know, she was 77, I think, when I worked with her. And I did a number of shows with her, actually. So I worked with her between when she was like 75 and when she passed away. And remarkable woman and dignified, hilarious, just a remarkable person. And frankly, it made a huge impression on me. As a collaborator and a performer and a human being, so outspoken and as you know from her earlier life, brave, but she also knew what her assets were, and one of those, or two of those, I should say, were her legs, and she loved to show her legs. And I remember one of our costume fittings, she basically took the dress she was wearing, which was a floor length sequiny kind of thing that made her look like a tree, because in my production she was sort of born from this tree and came out in the garden to answer Cinderella's plea. She played the fairy godmother in the show. And I remember one of the first things she did at the fitting is, she didn't do this in a crude way, but essentially she took the dress and ripped it right up. side so that she could kick her leg out. He said, there we go. There she is. And she made sure every night when she stepped out of that carriage for the curtain call, she gave a nice big kick to the audience, and it brought everybody up to their feet. Not that they wouldn't have anyway. But
a star knows.
A star knows. And she was really, in that sense, old school, in that she knew what she wanted, but she was very collaborative as well in terms of the performance, in terms of putting the show together. So she was a delight, and nobody worked harder. She would get up at 6 a.m. to do publicity wherever the show was playing, worked so hard. She would eat like 4 almonds a day. I don't know how she thought. In fact, my in-laws have an almond farm in Modesto, California, so we'd always bring her big bags of almonds, and she would love that. And I tried to get Blue Diamond to do a commercial with her. I could never stop imagining her waist deep in a pile of almonds and saying, "Bertha, kid eats almonds. You must eat them too," and doing a little cat cry or something. It would have been great. We even pitched it to them, but they didn't bite.
Oh, bite being a literal term there. Now, I said a star knows, getting back to the nose puns and Cyrano. Someone else who played Cyrano at one point off-Broadway is Frank Langella, who's going to be actually on Broadway this season in a different play. But you worked with him in 1989, actually the same year Starmites, in A Tempest. Also, B.D. Wong was in there. Now, yep. Langella has a bit of a reputation. Do you have any Frank Langella stories?
Well, I love Frank, by the way. I think anyone who's worked with him certainly respects him as an actor. He's a wonderful actor, and I learned from him greatly. And I was still a pretty young kid when I worked with him. I was very eager to soak up anything I could from him. I played his brother in the play, The Tempest, and at the very end of the show, Frank came out in dress rehearsal, and he said, "And you, brother," and without any notice or any warning, he hauled off with his right hand, which is quite huge, and smacked me across the side of my head. And it was so strong a hit that it actually, and surprised me, that it actually picked me up and landed me right on the floor, literally knocked me off my feet. And of course, nobody else on stage could believe he did that, because it was completely unrehearsed. He was just in the moment, I guess. But being the young, eager actor I was, I think I told him after the show, I said, "That was awesome. Do it again."
I hope he did not, because Equity would get involved. The Evan Handler thing with, what was his name, Nicole Williamson and all that.
Oh, yeah. That was around the same time. It was a little before then, I think. But at any rate, it was pretty funny. And again, I don't hold it against Frank. I may have encouraged it somehow in my attitude or my performance.
He did not do that again, I assume.
No, I don't think he did, actually. Somebody may have talked to him. I don't know. I didn't ever voice any objection to it.
It would have been wonderful for the play, but you have had brain damage by the end of the run.
It was one moment that came back to me, yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. Oh, my God. Well, what are another one or two people, that legends that you have worked with that you've either had wonderful or funny experiences or anecdotes about?
One of the first Equity shows I did as an actor, Actors Equity, the acting union, the first show that I did once joining the union was the first national tour of a show called Barnum, which is a wonderful musical by Cy Coleman. And this was the first national tour, just going out only, I think, a year after it opened on Broadway. And it starred Stacy Keach and the wonderful Dee Hody. And Stacy had been very athletic as a kid, but he was a football player and stuff. But he had a bum knee from that experience. And at the end of the first act in Barnum, he had to walk across stage on a tightrope, and Stacy worked on it tirelessly, but he was not agile in that way. He was very fit for his age, but again, he had kind of a bum knee, and he had trouble making the wire walk. And I remember we were in previews in New Orleans, and every night it was so disappointing. He would try 3 times, and eventually he'd have to come up with some ad lib that, "I guess I didn't make it," or I don't know. It was kind of embarrassing and sad in a way, because it was such a climactic moment. Finally, on opening night in New Orleans, he set out on that wire, and you could have heard us all screaming inside, "Go, Stacy, go," because we loved the guy. He was so affable and fun to work with and inclusive. And so we were all rooting for him. And as soon as he made the cross for the first time that week on the opening night, the curtain came down for intermission, and you could have heard a scream from the audience that was louder than the ovation at the end of the show from on stage, just congratulating him. It was such a warm moment, and I'll never forget that experience. And also loved playing poker with him because I felt like I was in a Western. Sometimes his brother, James Keach, would show up, and we'd be in this hotel room playing poker, and I'd have to keep checking under the table to make sure no one brought a gun because I felt like I was in a Western for some reason.
My goodness. But no, that I love that tightrope story, too. That's delightful. See, everybody thinks that we just want dirt and we want to hear bad things about famous people, but it's great to hear nice, lovely things about people. Do you have another story? It could also be a horrible, bad one. If there's someone you want to get revenge on and they're dead now and you'll never work with them again and you never would want to. Anybody like that?
I'm trying to think. One of the things that I've really tried to do is take the best from every situation I'm presented with, and as a director, my training was really getting a chance to work with some wonderful directors like Joe Layton, who directed the Barnum, like Tom O'Horgan, who I was blessed to work with two or three times, doing an opera as well as off-Broadway avant-garde theater, and working with Hal Prince, of course, on the Petrified Prince, a show by Michael John Lacusa that we did at the Public Theater many years ago.
Wasn't Daisy Prince involved in that too, his daughter or something?
Daisy, his daughter, played the female lead, and I played the sidekick to the male lead. And the male lead was Sandy Gaberman, who Daisy ended up marrying about a year later. And they're still together and have a family now. And Sandy is appears on many sitcoms and television shows, and he's a great guy. And so is Daisy, of course. And
can I ask you what you learned, if anything, since you're a director now, what you learned from Hal Prince when you were in The Petrified Prince?
Well, one of the things that it taught me is that, Hal is also, I guess, what you'd call old school, at least you would in the olden days call him old school. He was very funny, and he does certain things that I would never do as a director, but I appreciate as a director, such as give line readings or take a crown out of somebody's hand and say, do it like this, and you would act out the part and then say, now you do it. And as a director, having been an actor especially, as a director, I try to keep myself off the stage at all costs. Now, that's impossible to do in the current situation because I'm actually up there as an actor. But nonetheless, I never try to demonstrate how to do something. I try to use words to communicate ideas to actors. And, of course, that becomes very challenging, by the way, when I'm working in foreign countries and speaking through an interpreter. But in the case of Hal, I really enjoyed watching how he manipulated scenery and how he looked at the big picture and how he sort of conceived things and how devoted he was to the momentum of a piece and the rhythm of a piece and to the writing. So he would often cut things out, small things, little big things, to make the piece flow more smoothly. So I really appreciate his work as an architect and as someone who works with architecture really, really well.
Now, I have to ask, I assume Tom O'Horgan, who people probably know best from Hair, worked very, very differently.
Very differently. And so my work as a director becomes a culmination of all the people I worked with. Tom was extremely organic. I never got the sense he did any pre-production except to say, okay, build that or build something. But his pieces evolved extremely organically, and usually that meant the set scenery and props and stuff as well, which is a really great way to work if you can afford to do it. And he worked in many cases, on a small enough scale or off Broadway so that he could afford to do that. And he had a team of people around him building stuff as he needed it. So I really enjoyed working with him and really appreciated how organic he worked and how he let staging even evolve from the performers directly. I like to go in with a game plan, but I use consider that a backup plan and still like to see what happens in the room between actors, because I feel like there's so much rich opportunity there. So I tend to, or try to, look at my rehearsal process as a complete collaboration from everyone in the room. And I got a lot of that from Tom, really, really appreciated that aspect of what he taught me as well.
Can
and
I ask
Clayton,
you
know, was kind of a combination of both. I mean, he's very high energy, but extreme, thinks outside the box and thinks very, very physically and in pictures. And of course, I think theater is first and foremost a visual medium, and so I really appreciated that from him and the way he used, created a theatrical vocabulary for his shows that moved the show. And I've sought to do that in every show I've directed as well, and find what is the function of the ensemble here, and how can this show use what the show is about, not just where it takes place and who it's about, but what is the theme of any particular show, and how can it capitalize on that in visual ways and in ways to make the show flow and propel. And so I learned a lot of that from Joe Layton as well, and watching him and many, many other directors, some great directors and some not so great. I learned from them as well in terms of what not to do often. So
you don't have to mention a name, although you can. Who's a not so great director that you learned what not to do from? And what was
it
not?
One director started a rehearsal process, and I, you know, it's funny, in contrast with what I just said, you know, staying open to influence and to ideas, but you also don't want to start a rehearsal process saying, I don't know what to do.
Oh, boy.
You know, I don't know how this show is going to happen, but we'll do it together, okay? And I think it's really important to make sure the audience, the company feels secure, loved, and protected. And I do think, you know, this isn't demeaning in any way. I think there is a parental sort of relationship that's set up between a director and the rest of the team, and that's something I'm still learning and growing into in many ways. But people want authority, they need authority, they need direction. So I think being open and organic and influenced by all the ideas in the room is great, but there also has to be a firm hand, because people need that, they desire it, at least in the theater as it's constructed now. Obviously, one of the reasons we explored this idea of my directing and performing the role of Cyrano and directing a production came from a desire to explore the actor-manager relationship, because as many of you probably know out there, that the role of the director is only about 100 years old. Before then, actors did direct themselves, and usually with the lead actor that would take the lead and the charge of putting a show together. And so we were trying to explore that relationship as it might have been in the days of Molière, say, when this play takes place, even though it was written in the late 19th century. So that's a really interesting notion that over the last 100 years, I think, though, the role of the director has certainly not only come into being, but it's established itself certainly in the theater. I do think it's still an actor's medium, ultimately, because they're on the front line, and they're the ones that are, in the end, controlling the focus of the audience. But hopefully they're doing that with the help of the director and the rest of the design team to focus the action. And obviously in film, I think it's much more a director's medium, because they're in charge of very specifically what the audience sees at any given point.
Well, if you want to see how Gabriel Barry and the rest of the cast and the crew and the tech people of Cyrano de Bergerac are handling all of this, this self-direction and the other things that go on in performance and production, you have to go see Cyrano de Bergerac all through this month. It's Resonance Ensemble at the Theater at St. Clements. It's right in Midtown Manhattan. Obviously, having listened to Mr. Barry during this interview, you're going to want to go see it. You're going to want to see the intelligence and the fun that he brings to this production. But I do have one or two more last questions for Mr. Barry. A quickie I have to ask, because you've been cast occasionally as a Jewish person. Are you Jewish?
No, I'm not.
You're not Jewish. What are you, French-Canadian or something? What are you?
Yeah, French Canadian Barry, B-A-R-R-E, is a name that came down from Canada, I think, in the Huguenots many years ago. And my family settled in Vermont, and for many generations grew up there. So that's where I was born. And there is a Barry, Vermont, pronounced Barry, like a Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, is also spelled B-A-R-R-E. So it is a French French Canadian word. And but I was in the original cast of Rags, and so I played Jewish people many times. And,
right. That's why one of the reasons we wanted to ask about this is that you have played Jewish characters, including a role in a musical that got slammed by the critics, but the producer of this radio program, Dave, thought it was one of the best, most delightful musicals of the season. It was a show called Ain't Broadway Grand. Do you remember? Well, of course you remember. And you played a person named Marvin Fishbein. Do you have any Ain't Broadway Grand stories?
Oh, well, you can't follow that question without talking about Mitch Lee, I suppose. Mitch Lee is the composer of the show, who wrote, of course, most famously, Man of La Mancha, which is inarguably, I think, an amazing work, and loaded with some amazing songs. But he's got a huge Trump-sized ego, I would say, and very, very interesting, and I'd say even eccentric character. He did not direct the show officially, but hired a director who, unfortunately, was sort of forced to take a back seat to his running the rehearsal. So it was quite an experience to see that. And, you know, I think the New York press was somewhat prejudiced against him, partly because of what they heard about, I guess, his rehearsal manner or whatever. But he's a very talented guy and a very nice person in many ways, I think, from what I got to know. It was a certainly unique experience because of Mitch's hand on the show.
Do you think a different director would have made it more of a, would have helped and made it a hit?
I don't know. Hard to say. That's pretty much anyone's guess, I suppose. I think there was some great things. It was a really old-fashioned, traditional show about Mike Todd. There was a lot of humor in it, a great cast, an amazing ensemble of dancers, stunningly beautiful women and men dancing in the show, and some amazing choreography by Randy Skinner and others. So it was just a fantastic, a lot of elements were great. It's just a matter of what the appetite for that kind of entertainment was in that particular season that didn't help. And, another director, I'm not sure they'd have done. I mean, Scott got to work on it. Scott Harris was his name, but he got to contribute a lot. I'm not saying he didn't do anything, but Mitch had a habit of taking over the room, and there was not much anyone could do about it, including Drew.
Now, last, and I promise this is the last question for the delightful Gabriel Barry. Somewhere I read that one thing that you're working on, because an actor-director always has a zillion irons in the fire, but there's something called Other World. What is it, and what's happening with it?
Oh, wow.
That's, what?
You do your research, Rabbi.
Yeah, look, it's all in Hebrew, but yes.
This is a very exciting show. We can't talk too much about it yet because it's still in development, but it's really, really, really exciting show that is an original story written by Hunter Bell, who wrote Title of Show.
Oh.
One of his collaborators on that show, Jeff Bowen, is a co-composer with Anne McNamee, who's a wonderful talent who lives on the West Coast. And the three of them are the writers of the show, and I co-conceived the show with them and am directing it. And it's an original musical, contemporary musical, that takes place with the video gaming as the backdrop for the show. And, of course, it's about characters that are video game players as well as their avatars or video game characters. And I won't give away too much yet, but just suffice it to say that they get to interact with each other in more direct ways than they do usually through a controller. And it's a fantastic world to explore, if you will, a fantastic other world to explore. And we're beginning talks and discussions with a very, very exciting company to help realize the world and the characters. And we're also exploring with University of Connecticut and other outlets some truly groundbreaking technology by by which to sort of suggest this world on stage, and yet, of course, most importantly, keep it theatrical. So we're not going to be doing a movie on stage or anything like that. We're
it won't be all holograms and right.
Yeah, exactly. No, we're using puppetry and things that definitely still leave room for the audience's imagination, which I think is crucial for any theatrical endeavor. Anytime you use projections or any of that kind of thing to fill in that gap where the audience's imagination should be, I think you are really drifting out of the theater's realm. And so what I love about the theater is the fact that the imagination not only can be engaged but needs to be to enjoy any presentation in the theater. Certainly that's true with Cyrano, but it will also be true with something as eventually technical as Underworld will be.
Well, it has been a delight to directly engage with Gabriel Barry here in the neighborhood. Please, please go see Resonance Ensemble's production of Cyrano de Bergerac, co-adapted by and directed by and starring our friend Gabriel Barry. Gabriel, it's been an absolute delight having you in the neighborhood. I wish you much, much further success in your other world.
Rabbi, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure and joy talking to you, too, and really appreciate your support. Thank you so much, and hope you all can come see the show soon. Thank you.
Shalom to you.